You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here again with
Genevieve Kosky,
Scott Tobias.
Tasha Robinson won't be with us because, guys, this is hard to say, but she's on the run from the law.
She's been on the run for like 4 weeks.
I know. If anyone sees her, consider the romantic appeal of living on your own terms and just let her be, okay? In our last episode, we discussed the classic 60s Western Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. In this one, we'll cover The Old Man and the Gun, a David Lowery film starring Robert Redford that owes a lot to the other half of our pairing and many other films from Redford's career. The Old Man and the Gun began as a 2003 New Yorker article by David Gran about the life and career of Forrest Tucker, a criminal whose arrest record dated back to his teen years, as did his escapes from whatever facilities he was placed in, including San Quentin. The film mostly covers a later chapter in Tucker's career, when he and a gang of fellow agent bandits robbed a series of banks in the Southwest. Redford plays Tucker with a twinkle in his eye, and his partners in crime are played by Danny Glover and Tom Waits. The film co-stars Casey Affleck, as all Lowery films apparently must, as a lawman determined to take Tucker down, but who also kind of gets his antagonist's charm. Tucker's alluring also to a horse farm owner named Jewel, played by Sissy Spacek, who's drawn to him before she learns how he makes his money and stays with him after. But the film, while also charmed by Tucker, isn't blind to the consequences of the life he's chosen for himself and others. Another actor might have played Tucker and played him well, but the casting of Redford makes the film about two careers at once, Tucker's and Redford's, and his long history of playing rebels and rogues that dates back to Arthur Penn's The Chase in 1966, if not before. The California-born Redford could easily have coasted into leading man parts on his good looks alone, but he chose another path, and if this is Redford's last role, it's a lovely summation of what's made him such an appealing star. Like many of his performances, it's understated. He never seems to try too hard. He doesn't have to. He's Robert Redford. He can walk in, smile a little, say the right words, and steal a movie.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Excuse me, I'd like to open up an account.
Well, great. What type of account do you have in mind?
This kind. This kind.
You said he was armed.
He had a gun.
You saw it.
Well, he was also sort of a gentleman.
He was very polite.
He seemed like a nice enough fella.
Look at that. Is he smiling?
Five states.
93 robberies.
In 2 years.
You think you can catch him?
Yeah, I won't lie. I'd love to slap the cuffs on him myself. So I hope I get the chance.
Try another city, baby. Another town.
He spent his whole life locked up, except for the times that he broke out.
Somebody should have told him to quit while he was in.
Well, you find something you love.
I know exactly where I'm supposed to be.
You're never exactly where you're supposed to be, are you? Now, whenever I close the door, I think, is this the last time I'll ever have a chance to do whatever that thing was?
You know what I do when the door closes? I jump out the window.
Living is a gamble, baby. Loving's much the same. Wherever.
I sat down with him once and I said, surely there's an easier way to make a living. And he looked at me and he said, I'm not talking about making a living. I'm just talking about living.
All right, so what did everyone think about this movie? It's our third David Lowery movie.
I know. David Lowery and Steven Spielberg are two three-peats on this show.
Yeah, they're catnip to this podcast.
Well, I have a theory about that, which is that David Lowery makes the most Next Picture Show friendly movies imaginable, and I think almost to his detriment to some degree. I mean, we never did Eighth and Body Saints, but his films are so suggestive of the past that they feel like covers sometimes.
I love that movie, though. That's the movie that hooked me on David Lowery.
I know. But I mean, that one is, you know, that I was a little to Thieves Like Us.
Oh, yes.
And this one owes
and Terrence Malick. It's basically if Terrence Malick made Thieves Like Us, it would be The Body of Saints.
Yeah, and then Pete's Dragon is like, let's do the original Pete's Dragon, but in the style of filmmaking that I liked from that era. And then he's got this movie, which is an homage to Butch Cassidy in the classic Redford films of that era.
But
as
also
well.
Sort of like the low-key 70s crime movies.
Sure.
Well. Like the era in which it's set feels very...
Yeah, because they're covers. They're good. They're good, but they are covers. But
well, if he was a band, what band would he be?
I know. We got to figure that out.
Yeah, I think cover is maybe a little ungenerous. Like, it suggests that he is just like doing what's already been done before. Like, it feels...
Well, I think he's Arnell Pineda to Steve Perry.
No, I'm going
to
say he's more like Real Estate. Because I love the band Real Estate, but I know...
I thought you were just bringing in a whole metaphor.
No, stick with the music metaphor, because like, I love the band Real Estate, but I know it's partially because they got that jangly, REM-inspired college rock guitar of the late 80s, the sound I really respond
to. Better, that's a better one. I was being a
but
jerk.
But they're doing their own thing. Yeah, it's not cover so much
I think Lowry is more like playing in multiple sandboxes rather than like doing direct homage. I mean, there are elements of direct homage in this film specifically, and they're very tied up in the Redford character. But just to bring it back to like what we thought of this film, like I really loved this film, and I loved how like kind of just intimate and easygoing it felt. Like, I mean, it's ostensibly telling like this epic multi-state crime spree story, you know, cat and mouse, cops and robbers type of thing. But like when I think of this movie, I think of the scene of Robert Redford and Sissy Spacek sitting in a diner. You know, like that is the movie to me. That scene of their like first meal in a diner is probably one of my favorite scenes this year. Just the back and forth and the chemistry between them, where I think we're going to be talking leaning on chemistry a lot in this discussion, combined with the sort of the eagerness Lowry has to kind of highlight their faces and their age, and but still the life that is inside them. It's just, I found it really, really compelling. Like outside of the narrative, the emotions of this film are much more compelling to me than the narrative it's telling, which is a very like fun narrative, but it's not what I think of first and foremost with this movie.
No, I liked it too. I mean, I've been a bit of a wiseacre, but I did about it, but it's charming. It does it precisely what it's supposed to do, which is to be the movie equivalent of what Redford's character is doing here, of someone who robs you and you're kind of happy to have that experience. There are two things I thought about, two other great movies about thieves that I thought about when I was watching this film. One is Sam Fuller's line about pickpockets, how they're not like criminals, they're artists. That was one line that stuck out for me. And the other bit was one of the exchanges in the classic film Trouble in Paradise, which is a film about two pickpockets and thieves who fall in love. And that there's a scene where they have a conversation while also quietly robbing each other blind, taking each other's wallets and whatnot. And it felt like a small tickle or something when you took that the wallet out of my pocket or something like that. I mean, I'm completely mangling the quote, but it has that quality.
The Lubitsch touch right here.
The Lubitsch touch, but it has that quality to it of just like, you know, of course we're going to forgive this guy any of his trespasses because he's so winning. Mm-hmm. If it's possible to rob banks for the right reasons, he's doing that.
The reason he's robbing banks is because he loves it. And like, I think for Lowry and Redford alike, like based on interviews I've read with them for this movie, like they both see Forrest and what he does as sort of like an allegory for being an artist. He's not necessarily like making a lot of money. He's not rolling in cash as a result of what he's doing. And, you know, there's a lot of ups and downs, I guess you could say, to his career. And he doesn't need to be doing, arguably shouldn't be doing at the age he's doing it, but he loves it and he's good at it and he can't do anything else. And I think for, like I said, Lowry and Redford, they both connect to that through their own lens of making movies.
Well, he's such a people person too. I mean, those interactions that he does have with the people he robs, they're real conversations. I mean, they're almost like those.
You're doing great.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. You're doing great. And I mean, I think he's kind of, it's sort of a pleasure for him to get to know the person a little bit and mm-hmm. to have a little bit of an exchange that isn't fraught with the type of terror that you would expect from an armed robbery.
Yeah, you don't get the sense that he's like screwing with them or like necessarily taking delight. You know, I mean, he doesn't feel bad that they are scared or upset, you know, but he is not sadistic about what he is doing to these people.
It's right there in the title. I mean, he's got a gun. There's a threat of violence that hangs. I mean, this is, you know,
it's just a threat. It's just a threat.
And I don't think he'd ever act on it, but, you know, these people don't know that. I mean, we'll get to it with connections too, but these are not people who are not armed, you know. Anyway, just still, I'd give him all my money, you know. It's fine. And apparently he did at some point collect, you know, over the course of his career, something like $4 million. So there was money there for sure.
The real guy,
yeah. Yeah, not necessarily
but presumably, like, every time he was caught and went to jail, he like started back at zero, unless he, I don't know,
squirreled it away.
Yeah, I've had the New Yorker article on which this is based open for a couple days now and have not gotten around to reading it.
It's a cash business. It can be stowed and buried.
And we do see a little bit of that in the movie of him kind of tucking away his money, but it's never really returned to, because again, the money is not the point, I think, for either the character or the film.
Yeah, if it were more the point, we'd see him using it more.
Right.
Yeah, he'd have more nice things, or he'd have a place to live, right? I mean, or at least it's Sissy Spacek's character who has, a home.
Well, and she's the one who compels him to actually spend the money he makes. I love the scene with the bracelet, you know, where he like kind of nudges her into walking out with the bracelet, and you know, she kind of thinks about it and should I do this, and then she just kind of gives him a look like, no, we're not doing this, and like takes him back and makes him pay for it, which I really, really love the relationship between those two characters in this movie. It's definitely the high point of a movie for me that is, you know, I hold in high esteem overall, but really like them.
She's so great. I mean, we're gonna talk about Redford some more, but Spacek is so great. The supporting cast is so good. I mean, Glover and Tom Waits.
Tom Waits. He has that great little Why I Hate Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, that's just like, it's like the perfect Tom Waits monologue.
And Affleck's and Redford's big scene together on the way to the bathroom hallway is fantastic too. I mean, they're well cast film. But SpaceX's really having a year between this and Castle Rock. She's having a pretty good run.
In both cases with Redford and Spacek, they're veterans. They just occupy that space on screen. They're so charming with each other. They react to each other in a way that perhaps younger actors don't, where they feel like they're listening to each other. It's so easy with the two of them, just as it is, I guess we'll discuss later, with Redford and Newman. It's just like there's something so unpracticed and natural. And also, you know, that scene in the diner, which I would agree is really one of the highlights of the movie, that sizing up that he does of her, of just like, you can see him edging toward telling her everything, telling her what he does. And it involves getting to a point where he feels like she's not going to freak out about it.
Mm-hmm.
And even that she might for a while think he's being absurd and ridiculous and joking about it. And I love that. I completely buy that everything about that scene, that she is going to listen to these revelations and kind of buy into it.
I feel a little cheated. This is their first film together.
We
could have had years of them working together.
Yeah, and I mean, to again connect it to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid a little early, like the friendship between Redford and Newman on that film is like so legendary, but they hadn't worked together before then either, you know, like that was the beginning of their relationship and the beginning of their on-screen relationship, just like this is the beginning of Redford and Spacek's on-screen relationship. I don't know what sort of interactions, if any, they've had outside of movies, but it's sort of lovely to realize that this very lived-in seeming relationship is like existing wholly within their performances in this movie. It's not drawing on some sort of history that we all know. You know, it's all right there in the performances.
You can see in the way these characters have been conceived, too, about how complementary this relationship is, about how each of them gets something out of the other that was missing in their own lives. That Redford's character has a home to return to and has some level of stability and, you know, companionship that was missing before. And, you know, Spacek obviously also with companionship, but a little bit of danger and adventure and, taking her outside of her, far outside of her experience.
And interestingly, he tries to also give her, like, financial freedom. You know, like, there's that whole thing with him trying to buy her mortgage but not being able to do it without telling her or without bringing her in to take part in it. And there wasn't really like a resolution or payoff to that, I don't think, outside of that scene. But I think that's okay, because it's just like sort of an illustration of this like unbridgeable divide, I guess, or this thing that is between them. That same with the kind of the bracelet scene. Like, there's a certain like barrier that they can't cross, but the barriers they can cross in their relationship still adds up to something like rewarding and worthwhile for both of them.
Here's a fun fact about this movie. So it's set mostly in Texas, but shot mostly in Ohio. And there's a scene where they're staking out a bank. This is maybe just fun to me. The scene where they're staking out a bank, and it's like, I'm not sure where they shot this. It's just a really good job of a city that stuck in the early 80s. And it looks vaguely familiar. And then I realized they filmed it in my hometown of Dayton, Ohio. And I love the idea of Tom Waits and Danny Glover and Robert Redford all looking down on downtown Dayton. But that's the most
modern of cities.
But it's coming back. We're turning it around.
Yeah, they're probably, though, probably solidly some aspects of the 80s that have just stayed and not evolved there, for sure.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You could make it work.
I mean, the time period is pretty important to this movie, I think, and specifically to its theme of freedom or being able to live outside certain bounds of society. And, like, it takes place, again, like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, like, kind of at the end of an era, like, before the internet and, you know, all of our mobile devices just like made the whole world a lot smaller and made it a lot harder to live under the radar, you know, and also changed the way that criminals are pursued and found as well, you know. And like, this is a story, not just a narrative, but a story that only really works in a transitional period like this, before you have those just changes in how we communicate and relate and live our lives in the world, you know.
Within the film itself, it's a story that's sort of, you know, made for that, like, and a news of the weird part of the local news, which becomes fodder for that too. That's kind of how it travels around.
The Over the Hill gang, they would be a viral phenomenon today, you know, but they're just and another thing on the local news.
Yeah, the film does a pretty good job of showing you how difficult an effort it would be to do the coordination necessary to bring someone like this to justice, to drag files from all across the country in order to establish a pattern and try to anticipate what he's going to do next. I mean, that's not easy work. At least it wasn't. Yeah, I think it's probably not easy work now, but it's surely much easier than it would have been then. Yeah.
I mean, there's just like kind of an analog vibe to the whole movie, and it was shot on 16 millimeter, but like just within the movie itself, like sort of the detective work or like the technology we see used, like it's all very like there's that thing with the rewinding and fast forwarding of the tape, and like can't quite get the exact frame you need, and there's like all this kind of fiddling with the machine, and then there's like the fiddling with the recorder when he's talking to Elizabeth Moss's character, and there's just all this very like sort of like tactile textural stuff around the analog technology in this film that I think is just like kind of a piece with the feel of the movie.
I'm always on board with that sort of fetishization, as you know.
Yeah. As soon as I said analog, Scott's eyes just lit up.
How do we feel about the ending? Because it is kind of an upbeat ending in its own way, but I also, he's giving up stuff. He's giving up the woman, like the best woman you could have in his life, I think. And I think the Elizabeth Moss, it's a fairly late in the film when we meet the daughter he has never cared to know. And this is, it doesn't really disrupt the fun spirit of the film, but I think it also, you know, like in Butch Cassidy, not to get to comparisons mm-hmm. too soon, but it is a minor chord sounding yeah. in the middle of all this.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's got that undercurrent of melancholy that's very strongly tied, I think, to Butch Cassidy, which is a stated inspiration for this film. Right. Like, I mean, Lowry went into this with Redford in mind specifically because of that film and The Sting and the character he played there. So.
It has an opening card that this true is mostly a real story or something, or whatever yeah. it is, some sort of rewording
yeah,
of...
Yeah,
of...
it's a very clear echo.
And I think we do need to understand that there are consequences to his way of life, real human consequences, because I think mm-hmm. you could make this movie and not feel that at all, you know.
Then it just is a news of the weird item,
right? Yeah. I mean, the fact that that people don't get hurt. I mean, I was thinking that when he was during the film's one big car chase, thinking like, you know, this goes like a lot of car chases go. If you could have car crashes and pedestrians potentially getting hit, and you know, a lot of things that he by nature would be disturbed by, and not. I mean, he's in it for fun. He's in it for sport, and it's something he enjoys doing. But when there are real people who might suffer as a result of that, that way it would weigh on his conscience and also weigh on the film's depiction of him as someone who's able to do this lightly and somebody who can root for.
Yeah, and I think that's why the relationship between Forrest and Jewel is so important to this movie, because you have to understand that what he's sacrificing is that emotional connection that they have, and by extension, all the emotional human connections he had beforehand. You know, his daughter, like you said, the daughter he never knew, and whoever else he, you know, met in the interim between his 13 escapes from prison, you know, and like, he has some connections that extend between those stints in prison. Like, his cohorts in the Over the Hill gang are, you know, apparently cronies from way back. But for the most part, it seems like he just kind of, you know, he lives. He really, really lives in these breaks between incarceration. And that's when he, like, experiences freedom, you know, like, again, to kind of go back to the theme of being free and outside the bonds of society. You know, jail is the literalization of that. And we're seeing him in the time in his life when he is not bound by that, literally or figuratively.
We're already kind of edging into connections, so let's just take a quick break here. We'll be right back after that break to talk about the connections between Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and the Old Man and the Gun.
Oh, you crying? Don't cry. What are you crying for?
It's just my first day.
Well, there's always a first time for everything, isn't there? Chin up. You're doing a great job.
Now it's time for connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about the things they have in common. Well, we can start with the obvious, which is Robert Redford at different phases of his career, though.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the title. I didn't realize until you put them together that, like, oh, these titles actually follow the same convention as well.
That's true. That's true. I think he plays the old man, though.
Yeah. He goes from the kid to the old man.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know what? It's the most obvious possible parallel, and I just now noticed it. Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, I didn't either. That was pretty good.
Right, one connection we can check off the list.
Yeah. But Robert Redford, different phases in his career, but still, I think, very much the same movie star in many, many ways. I mean, it helps that he's aged beautifully into this really striking older person. But, you know, he's still got that glint, and he can do so much with just a little bit. I mean, there's a movie star thing, and he's got it.
Yeah, though, I mean, the risk with him is he could be boring. There have been films where he's done that, and it hasn't felt like a strong enough presence, or you feel like there's...
What are you thinking of? What comes to mind? Boring Redford.
Boring Redford. Well, I almost think of him more... Maybe I'm thinking much more of his directorial career.
I was about to say, like, maybe he tends to do better when he is playing off another strong performance, as he is in both of these films. But then I think of All Is Lost, which is all him and only him. And I think that is an incredible performance as well. So, you know, shut my mouth.
But that's like an unfinished life. I mean, that's just a boring movie, though.
So All Is Lost? I love it.
No, an unfinished life.
All Is Lost is phenomenal. I'm thinking more, maybe something like Indecent Proposal, for example, as being not a particularly exciting Robert Redford performance. But
it's so naughty. Naughty premise, but got people talking.
You know, I quibble too much. He is quite,
it's a pretty good filmography.
He's quite good. And I think he's like one of those actors who understands what his range is, what he's good at, and then he plays to it. He's not somebody who's going to put on an accent or try to push himself too much. And I think on the other side end of things, the filmmakers realize what they're getting with Robert Redford, and the good ones like David Lowery can get something really great out of him.
Did you see Our Souls at Night?
No,
I didn't either. I wonder if it's any. I should catch up with that at some point.
No, I didn't. But it's nice to see him in this role in Old Man of the Gun and in All Is Lost, which is just like the perfect minimalist performance for a minimalist film. He doesn't need to impress anybody. He's been doing this for a while. He has that movie star confidence and knows that he doesn't have to do a lot to give the impression that he needs to give, and give the movie what it needs.
But it's notable that as evidenced by this connection is not because of his age or because he does have, you know, like he had that same confidence in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid when he was, you know, just a little baby movie star, you know. it's part of, maybe it's the California thing, I don't know, but it's like, or maybe it's just, you know, the confidence that comes with being an incredibly good looking human being, but you know, it was always there.
I want another thing that unites these movies is their attitude toward crime, which I would say is basically the same. I mean, I think it's basically, these are people who live outside the law because it's the only way they know how to be free, you know, and that's, I think that's true of both of them. And I think it's also the downside of that. It's also, it becomes a compulsion. Both this character and the Old Man, the Gun, and the Sundance Kid are people who stick at it a little too long. I mean, it's a less tragic ending here, but there is definitely losses associated with his persistence.
In Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, like the big loss of life or the violence happens like when they go straight, you know, like Butch makes his first kill when they've gone straight and they're, you know, doing this payroll guarding job, you know, and like that's a kind of beautiful moment of irony. But I think it also kind of speaks to the vein of crime that is being pursued in both of these movies. And like, I wouldn't quite call them victimless crimes, but they're more targeted at institutions that can presumably absorb the loss in a way that individuals can't, whether like monetary or physical loss. So I think like in terms of situating both these stories in the realm of robbery and specifically robbery of banks and or railroads, you know, that have these big institutions behind them, it's sort of lessens the human impact of their crime and makes it a little easier, I think, to sort of find the fun in what they're doing without having to dwell on the harm they cause.
So I mean, that kind of brings us to another thing we're going to talk about, which is about the whole thing of going straight, which seems to be an impossibility for his characters in both these movies.
It's not really anything he wants to do at any point. I mean, this is what he's chosen to do. And so it's both hard and undesirable, really.
In Butch Cassidy, it's not Sundance's idea. Like, Butch is the one who kind of points them in this direction. And Forrest is sort of forced into this brief period of being a law-abiding citizen that he clearly hates and is visibly wilting.
He's also being forced to serve the time too, right? Yeah. That's what condition. Oh,
that's interesting. Like, I didn't even like think of the little bit we see of him actually in jail, because like in terms of thinking about him going straight, like I just think so much about those scenes we get of him like living with Jewel and sort of shuffling around the house and just being visibly stifled. But you're right, we also do see him in jail, and it just like makes clear that is just sort of an extension of his time in prison. It's just like another sort of shackling, just without actually being in jail.
Yeah, I mean, I really like that whole scene where he gets put in jail and she visits him and he shows her the list of all of these breakouts that he's done in the past, and you get that kind of Rushmore montage later of all of the various ways he busted out of jail in the past. And that,
including clips from The Chase and I think Brubaker as well.
Yeah, those,
with younger Robert Redford.
Yeah, seamless.
Real quick, speaking of, what is the movie that we see Forrest and Jewel watching?
It's Two Lane Blacktop, which would definitely be playing at a small town Texas theater in the early 90s. But it's the perfect, you know, that scene is perfect. That's like, if I don't get grounded soon, I'm going to go into orbit. It's just sort of the perfect for him, where his head was at the time.
I really liked to see filmmakers just go ahead and just take the latitude and just say they're watching. Of course, they're watching Two Lane Blacktop. I watched an episode recently of The Deuce where characters just sitting there watching and memorizing a monologue from Blue Collar, the Paul Schrader film Blue Collar. It's like, of course, you know, why not? That film was not a hit, but sure, I get it.
Is that Sunday's episode?
That's Sunday's episode. Okay, well, it's not Sunday. I mean, for the listeners,
they're
it's
all
gonna
Sundays.
Be...
No, saying,
it's one you've seen. I haven't.
It's one that you will that people will have seen if they watch the show.
Your next picture show. If you're not watching The Deuce, watch The Deuce.
That's pretty good. But I give them that. I'm happy to give them that latitude.
Yeah.
But going back to that scene in the jail where he gives that list to Jewel, I forget exactly how she reacts, but she basically kind of compels him, like, or is like, maybe you don't do that this time, you know? Yeah. And it's like an echo of that bracelet scene again, like kind of her reining in his instincts. And again, it kind of maybe being this baseline difference between them, that for all the lovely connection they have, like ultimately it can't be resolved.
We could talk about the female allies in these films. I think Etta is much more of a better than Jewel is, although they're both complicit in their own way.
Yeah, and I think they both kind of find it somewhat charming what the men in their lives do. I mean, obviously they are charming men, but like Jewel is not going to, as you say, abet Forrest's crimes, but she, I think, is also a little like intrigued by them for sure, until she actually finds the gun in his glove compartment, which I think is a moment for her where it kind of crystallizes that, you know, this is perhaps a little more real than she had been, you know, making it out to be in her head, romantic.
Etta's a whole lot more engaged in the criminality. Yeah. I mean, she's out there firing a pistol herself at one point once they get to Bolivia.
Yeah.
So it's a much different relationship. But I do like, in the old Man in the Gun, I do like those moments where Forrest bends to her will a little bit. The bracelet scene in the jail where it's like it does get to be too much for her. It does cross a line, and he's willing to go against his instinct to commit a crime or to try to plot a prison escape and give something back to her and be influenced by that relationship, and rather than follow his renegade instinct.
I mean, he is until he isn't. He's willing until he isn't.
That's true.
You know? And
he tries.
Yeah, and I think that just kind of goes back to the idea of there just being this line of melancholy going through this film, as with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Like, for all the fun and freedom represented in his lifestyle, it comes at a cost. And kind of the centerpiece emotional connection of the movie is that cost. It's the thing that he gives up, and it's sad.
Yeah.
So we learn a lot about how bank robberies happen, you know, watching in the Old West and in the early 80s and this. I kind of left thinking, Old Man of the Gun, I could probably do that. Maybe not now. But
you could maybe in 1981.
Yeah, I think I learned enough from that movie to know how to do it then.
Do you think you can pull off the swagger and confidence of a Forrest Tucker walking into a bank? Because, like, I mean, that is his mechanics of robbery. It's just being very confident and charming,
and choosing the right moment.
Yeah,
I mean, I think the timing as
he sits down. I mean, it's like, I think he's like savoring the experience. He gets in the bank, he sits down, he scopes things out. He's very casual about how he goes up to the teller. He's very casual about how he leaves. He's not somebody who's going to run,
Or could run or at that point in his life.
Sure, yeah. But I mean, at any point, I mean, he's not the type to squeal away at any great speed. I mean, I think he just, you know, I think this is it's something he enjoys doing. And, you know, in like a good meal, you just want to get everything you can out of it. And whereas with Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, it's necessarily a much more of a smash and grab job that they're trying to do. Though they do it with, you know, as personally as possible. I absolutely love the bits with the train robbery where they're going back and forth with the company man who's really, you know, trying to be a good employee and really has to kind of put, you know, to stand in their way. And he does way more than he should do. And I love that they tease him for that. And ultimately, well, they end up hurting him, but all that stuff is really fun. I you know, I confess that is the part of Butch Cassidy that I really love the most, is just seeing the two of them do jobs.
Well, and when we get to Bolivia, I mean, we mentioned the Etta teaching them Spanish, and it's really kind of, you know, to put it in the context of the mechanics of robbery, like they don't have their most valuable tool, which is their words, you know, like that sort of amiability, you know, that they have when they're robbing the train, you know, like they don't have that when they're speaking a language they only have the most tenuous grasp of, and they eventually get the hang of it, you know, as the montage progresses. But those early robberies in Bolivia like have a much more like chaotic, uncontrolled vibe to them because they don't have the control of language that gives them the control of the situation. When I say them, I more mean Butch. Sundance Kid doesn't do a whole lot of talking in the robberies. But yeah, they don't have that advantage, I guess, that they have in America. And just real quick, I do want to note that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid opens with that great little scene of Butch kind of casing a bank and looking and being like, why they change a beautiful old bank that was here? It's because it was too easy to rob, you know? And that probably ties into the whole like end of an era aspect of that movie as well. But also kind of feels a little bit of an, like an echo of what I was saying about Old Man and the Gun being set in sort of the end of the era in which you could rob a bank in the manner that he does, you know, like banks in the Old West were evolving past a point where Butch could rob them as he had grown accustomed to doing, so had to go to Bolivia to do it, I guess.
Yeah, but still, you know, better than now and Old Man and the Gun. Still not quite enough technology to stop this old man doing what he wants to do. Yeah. He just has to put on the fake mustache and
and just gesture to his waistband. It's unclear to me if he ever actually I don't know if he ever even takes the gun into the bank or if he just keeps it in the car, because like there's that one little interaction between Casey Affleck and the bank manager after he got robbed, and he was like, did you see the gun? And the guy's like, he's unsure, you know, he's like, well, he gestured and I think I saw it, but it's very clear that whether or not there was a gun, he wasn't like brandishing it in a threatening way. The implication of a gun was enough.
Well, with that, we can wind things down with some gun talk from our resident gun expert, Genevieve Kosky. Oh,
no, I don't want to be that.
So Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is available to stream on all the usual services. You watched it on Amazon Prime, right?
I actually watched it on HBO Go, which Scott informs me was a bad choice.
Well, they blow it up to 1.8.
Oh, no.
Oh,
you didn't watch it at all.
Yeah.
Though. You got to watch it again.
But it might be different on Amazon Prime, though. Amazon Prime usually does a better job.
Yeah, they don't. Unless it's like sometimes I've seen like old obscure stuff that's basically just they ported over a VHS copy, but generally speaking, they keep the aspect ratio.
So I went to, because that was one I didn't have in my DVD collection, so I went on to iTunes, and the difference between the rental fee and the fee to purchase is $1. So I purchased the film for $5, and it's got tons of extras on it, and you know, certainly worth picking up. If you like things digitally, I don't, you know, digital ownership, that's a whole nother can of worms. But
I'm betting that Keith watched it on a nice Blu-ray that he has.
I was gonna say, you know what else has tons of extras? The Blu-ray. Actually, it's one of those things where it's like it has a price tag on it from the used record store where I bought it. It's like for $7 or whatever. And it's just sort of like one of those things where like, yeah, I'll need that someday. And you know what? Someday came this week.
We really covered the spectrum of viewing experiences for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Projected, which I've never seen, which I'd love to see
Keith
someday.
Keith won this round.
Yeah, and I lost. I watched the worst. I'm sorry. But I still liked it. You know what? It's a good film.
It is fun.
Projected films. You can see The Old Man and the Gun at a theater near you.
Not in 16,
and should.
Though.
What's
that? You can't see it in 16 millimeter, though. That would be nice if you could see it on film.
Yeah, well, you know, take what you can get. Yeah. It's a lovely conversion. Very, very filmic. We'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it will put some interesting choices on your radar. Genevieve, what in the film world has been good for you lately?
Well, what's been good for me lately is a film called Bad Times at the El Royale, which is Drew Goddard's first feature as both writer and director since Cabin in the Woods. I love that film. I think we all love that film here. So this was definitely one of my most anticipated movies of the fall. While I don't think it quite raises to the same level as Cabin in the Woods, there's a lot in this movie that's just really unique and special and definitely worth seeing in a theater.
Is it the Cabin in the Woods for like Tarantino-esque movies, or
that's definitely one way to think of it. Yeah, but it is probably a movie where like the less you know going in, the better, and that is not so much having to do with narrative twists as just like it's a really kind of fun and surprising viewing experience that I think if you take a frame of reference like Tarantino into it, it's going to maybe take away some of the surprise, which maybe I've just done, but also like you probably get some of that from the trailer as well. So if you haven't seen the trailer, avoid it and maybe just go see the movie. But I will kind of give you the broad strokes of what happens. It's about seven strangers who are trapped in this highly stylized mid-century hotel that straddles the state line between Nevada and California. And based on that setup and based on Goddard's history working on TV's Lost and The Good Place, I don't think it's a spoiler to tell you that this is all an extended purgatory metaphor. And it's very interesting when viewed through that lens. Chief among the ensemble are Jeff Bridges, who's always great, of course, John Hamm, Dakota Johnson, Chris Hemsworth, and I particularly want to highlight Cynthia Erivo, who is a Tony Award-winning musical theater actress who gets a lot of opportunity here to show off her skills. There's a lot to recommend this film, from the twist-filled story to its smart use of music. Keith, you're going to love the music in this movie, to the really just captivating, delightful production design. But as a fan of Erivo, I was particularly happy to see her get such a central and well-realized role here. And I hope that this is the start of a breakout career in Hollywood for her. She also has a starring role in Steve McQueen's upcoming Widows, which I am looking very forward to seeing. Have you seen it yet?
Fantastic, yeah. Yeah, she's quite good. I mean, everyone is good in that.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing her in that as well. But going back to Bad Times at the El Royale, just in all, this film is kind of a blast from beginning to end. It's full of like surprises and just big cinematic bombast. By the time you hear this, it will have been out in theaters for a couple of weeks. And I hope that if you haven't already seen it, you will go to the theater and treat yourself to Bad Times at the El Royale. Guys, I really want you to see this.
No, I'm very excited, and we'll see it at the first opportunity.
For sure. Maybe we'll go together.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that'd be something. Yeah. We've done that.
Yeah.
Fahrenheit 11.9, wasn't that great?
You're not going to Mexico or anything, are you?
I'm going to Mexico. Yes, sometimes school raffles pay off.
You know, you're like the third friend of ours that like hit the jackpot at school raffles.
Yeah, it's big time. Yeah. But I mean, it's a big bet. You're making a big bet. But our thing was like, you know, we have to support the school. We got to get a solid check in there, and then boom,
Mexico.
You draw your name on a hat, and you go to Mexico.
All right. Well, Scott, before you leave, what give us a film recommendation?
Before leaving, I went on a binge, and I've seen so much that I've liked lately that I can't do it all. I'm going to do two things, but before that, I'm going to preface that by saying I finally saw Support the Girls.
Yay.
Which is instantly one of my favorite films of the year. It's just,
Support the Girls.
So good. So good. I can't even get into it because I would talk too much about it. But I think it is, when we think about what American independent film is, and you associate it with, you know, sort of low key character study, mm-hmm. quirky comedy type of thing. Like, this film does that in such a substantive way, in such a, so full of humanity and life, and very Demi-esque. But I'm going to leave that there. I'm also going to leave Mandy alone, but I loved Mandy, especially on the big screen. So if you can get out to see Mandy, which has become like this cult, instant cult success, and it is audiovisually speaking, you know, it's like annihilation level, like overwhelming. Just try to do it because it's awesome. So I'm going to leave those behind, but I'm not doing those, even though I just said a bunch of stuff about them. But I did want to recommend two things. One, I wanted to quickly recommend the new podcast, Halloween Unmasked, which is produced by The Ringer and some other folks. It is hosted by Amy Nicholson, who is a great critic and pal. She wrote for Keith back in Up Rock's days, and she's got something going for me on Musings that's going to run at the end of October. Terrific critic, but she hosts, and it just gives you this wonderful context for this movie that came out of nowhere and just changed horror filmmaking forever. It's 6 episodes long. You know, they're all pretty digestible episodes. They're probably about 45 minutes a piece. They're spackled with interviews with Carpenter and with Jamie Lee Curtis and, you know, a lot of the other important collaborators of that film. And they're just illuminated by Amy's, you know, insight and scholarship and passion, and it's a treat. It's very much like you must remember this. Of course, it's similar to that, but focused on Halloween. Come on, it's great. So I can recommend that. And then the other thing I wanted to recommend, again, quite accessible, is a movie called Private Life, which is the new film by Tamara Jenkins. It is on Netflix. I haven't seen Roma yet, but of the Netflix, it is the best original Netflix film I've seen. It's
excuse me, you still haven't watched To All the Boys I've Loved Before?
Okay, I have to see that too. So there's,
and how many of this Mr. Adam Sandler's films have you seen on the
I saw Meyerowitz Stories, which was my favorite before Private Life. So in any case, this is the new film by Tamara Jenkins, who's only done 3 features in her career. She made Slums of Beverly Hills in 1998. She did The Savages in 2007, and she's done this now. It's another film about family. It is another comedy drama that's full of, you know, a lot of serious stuff and a lot of funny stuff, and she's really good at both. This is a movie about a couple played by Paul Giamatti and the great Catherine Hahn, who are in their 40s, are trying to have a kid and are having a lot of problems biologically making that happen. And so they're trying to hedge their bets, which is part of the comedy of the film, in the sense that they're trying to go for various medical treatments, in vitro fertilization, egg donation. There's a lot of things going on in that department, and it gets into incredible detail about that. And then they're also on the side trying to go for an adoption as well. So there's a very funny scene where Paul Giamatti is hustling around the house to hide all the fertility medicine that she's taking. So that's good stuff. It's a movie that gets into, as I said, all of these details about these procedures and how taxing they are and how emotionally draining they are. But ultimately it is a film about a marriage, and about a marriage that seems to be missing something. And the something that is missing, they determine, is a child, and that's going to fill in whatever that missing thing is. Where the film winds up at the end of this odyssey is just so perfect. It's got the best kind of denouement I've seen in a really long time. Tamara Jenkins just finds a perfect ending for the movie. I loved it. It's long. It's a little over 120 minutes, but quite engrossing and full of humanity and humor. So I dig it. Private Life. It's on Netflix. Extremely easy to find.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to having some time to watch it. I love Catherine Hahn. So
yeah, she gets to get, when she gets like steamed up in this movie, she's so funny. She just has that ability to drop all sorts of profanity, and she gets upset in very interesting ways. So I dug it. Keith, what about you?
For various articles, I was watching a lot of horror remakes from the 2000s for a piece I did for The Ringer. And
so you're going to recommend all of them?
No, I can't really. I mean, the ones The ones I watched anew, I was hoping to find some really pleasant surprises. Like, I thought I'd be blown away by Kimberly Pierce's Carrie remake, and it's not bad. It's okay, you know. So I don't have a whole lot there.
Did you ever see the other Carrie remake? The Rage Carrie 2?
Yeah, that's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
But that's a sequel. I mean, that's a direct sequel.
That's true.
And then I watched a lot of John Carpenter films for a couple other things, and, you know, there's fantastic stuff there, but I'm not going to surprise anyone there. So I got two.
Keith likes a John Carpenter film?
I know, no kidding. I got two quick ones. One is Cruise, which I can't really recommend objectively. It's our pal Robert Siegel, who we worked with at The Onion, and he wrote The Wrestler. He wrote and directed Big Fan. He's been around. This is his second directorial effort, and I think it's a really fun 80s nostalgic 80s thing, kind of in the mold of John Sayles' Baby It's You, kind of a Wrong Side of the Tracks romance in some ways. And, you know, it didn't get that much of a theatrical release, but it's readily available on your streaming services. I think the other thing I got to do recently was a Redford deep dive, and I guess the one that I knew was I enjoyed, but I forgot how much I enjoyed, is Sneakers. This 1992 sort of crime/spy film he did, in which he plays a sort of late 60s proto hacker who has had to go on underground for his anti-government activities, who now runs a security firm, like checking the security on banks. So, you know, another parallel there. And it's just this, you know, it's just really light on its feet, you know, spy thriller that comes from a particular moment in time. It's that it was released in 1992, and there's all these things about how the Cold War is over. Maybe the Russians are our friend now. Like, it's a movie that could not have been made just a few years later. It's got this great supporting cast, like Sidney Poitier. His team is Sidney Poitier, David Strathairn, River Phoenix, Dan Aykroyd. Mary McDonnell is a great supporting role. Stephen Tobolowsky is one of his best supporting roles. I mean, it's really just top to bottom fun, light on its feet stuff. But it's also, as Scott and I have discussed off mic, but it's like weirdly prescient. It is all about how people who have access to information will have power, you know, if not now, then, you know, next year.
It gets really specific too. It's incredible.
Shutting down power grids, that kind of stuff, changing flight plans. Yeah. And it's like, oh, well, you knew what was coming. So it's directed by Phil Alden Robinson, who did Field of Dreams. He's got a pretty good track record too. So if you haven't seen Sneakers, hey, see Sneakers. It's good.
It is good. Yeah. I can kind of double up on the Cruise recommendation, which is so movie crazy too. It's got, I mean, you mentioned Baby It's You, but also, you know, Diner and Risky Business, and I mean, it's a movie that really wears its influences very outwardly. You know, watching the film, what he had in mind making it.
My favorite thing also is how specific the period details are. Like, the main character and his pals, their scam is stealing car radios and selling them to like a sleazy video store owner, which is only takes place in a, you know,
those types of radios too that you can just kind of just scoop right out of. It's an interesting movie.
Well, that's it for this edition of The Next Picture Show. Our next pair will come out October 30th and November 6th. Genevieve, what's on the docket?
Bradley Cooper's debut as an actor-director, A Star is Born, is the fourth film to bear that title, in the latest evolution of a parable of rising and falling fame that's been around in different incarnations since the 1930s. Like its direct predecessor, the 1976 version starring Barbara Streisand and Kris Kristofferson, Cooper's version shifts the action from its original Hollywood milieu to the world of music, but it also functions in many ways as a Hollywood musical, which is both the setting and the form taken by George Cukor's 1954 version starring Judy Garland as the ascendant star to James Mason's fading matinee idol. Given that, it's Cukor's Star is Born that we'll be looking at in tandem with the newest version starring Cooper alongside Lady Gaga in the Judy Garland role, to see how the story changes with its time, setting, and lead actress, and to consider what's made this particular narrative endure over the decades.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Old Man and the Gun, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may post your response on Facebook for discussion or read it on a future episode of the show. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Genevieve?
You can find my work at the culture section at vox.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. Scott?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias, and you can find my work at NPR, at the New York Times, at Washington Post, and other fine outlets. I also am the editor-in-chief of Oscilloscope's Musings blog, which this month features our second round of produced and abandoned essays inspired by the classic National Society of Film Critics anthology book, Produced and Abandoned, in which films that were dropped by the studio but have a tremendous amount of value to them. This month's contributors are such esteemed film critics as Amy Nicholson, the aforementioned Amy Nicholson, April Wolfe, Bill Gobieri, and Joshua Rothkopf. So
that's a good lineup.
Yeah, that's right. I'm getting the cream of the crop.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And being able to write about, always like to allow people to write about those hidden gems they feel.
What are some of the films?
Amy Nicholson's on Alpha Dog, which is pretty interesting. And I've got, Bilga's on Black Hat.
Okay.
And Josh Rothkopf is on Prince of Darkness.
Right, nice. Yeah.
So look forward to that. Keith, what about you?
Oh, I'm a freelance writer. I'm all over the place. You can find me at The Ringer. You can find me at Vulture. You can find me at The Verge, Rolling Stone occasionally, you know, and I'm on Twitter at KPhipps3000. I collect my clips at KeithPhipps.com. And yeah, you can find our absent co-host, Tasha Robinson, if catch her. You can find her at The Verge, where she runs the film and TV coverage, and on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at Next Picture Pod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/Next Picture Show. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. And while you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks to Dan the Steak Jakes for his assistance producing the podcast. And thanks to Genevieve Kosky for providing recording space in her home base, Genevieve Kosky's apartment. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time.
And love, I can find it again in someone sitting close in the flashes of sin. There are other ways I used to think to find my way around the wood and the shell and the word of farewell that always had to sound.